The Captain and the Enemy, written by Graham Greene and read by Kenneth Branagh.
Part 1, Chapter 1. I am now in my 22nd year, and yet the only birthday which I can clearly distinguish among all the rest is my 12th, for it was on that damp and misty day in September I met the captain for the first time. I can still remember the wetness of the gravel under my gym shoes in the school quad, and how the blown leaves made the cloisters by the chapel slippery as I ran recklessly to escape from my enemies between one class and the next. I slithered and came to an abrupt halt, while my pursuers went whistling away, because there, in the middle of the quad, stood our formidable headmaster, talking to a tall man in a bowler hat, a rare sight already at that date, so that he looked a little like an actor in costume, an impression not so far wrong, for I never saw him in a bowler hat again. He carried a walking stick over his shoulder at the slope, like a soldier with a rifle. I had no idea who he might be, nor, of course, did I know how he had won me the previous night, or so he was to claim, in a backgammon game with my father. I slid so far that I landed on my knees at the two men's feet, and when I picked myself up, the headmaster was glaring at me from under his heavy eyebrows. I heard him say, "I think this is the one you want, Baxter 3. Are you Baxter 3?
"Yes, sir," I said. The man, whom I would never come to know by any more permanent name than the captain, said,
"What does 3 indicate?"
"He is the youngest of 3 Baxters," the headmaster said, "but not one of them is related by blood."
"That puts me in a bit of a quandary," the captain said. "For which of them is the Baxter I want? The Christian name, unlikely as it may sound, is Victor. Victor Baxter. The names don't pair very well."
"We have little occasion here for Christian names. Are you called Victor Baxter?" the headmaster inquired of me sharply.
Yes, sir. I said after some hesitation, for I was reluctant to admit to a name which I had tried unsuccessfully to conceal from my fellows. I knew very well that Victor, for some obscure reason, was one of the unacceptable names, like Vincent or Marmaduke.
"Well, then, I suppose that this is the Baxter you want, sir. Your face needs washing, boy."
The stern morality of the school prevented me from telling the headmaster that it had been quite clean until my enemies had splashed it with ink. I saw the captain regarding me with brown, friendly, and what I came to learn later from hearsay, unreliable eyes. He had such deep black hair that it might well have been dyed, and a long, thin nose which reminded me of a pair of scissors left partly ajar, as though his nose was preparing to trim the military moustache just below it. I thought that he winked at me, but I could hardly believe it. In my experience, grown-ups did not wink, except at each other.
"This gentleman is an old boy, Baxter," the headmaster said. "A contemporary of your father's, he tells me."
"Yes, sir."
"He has asked permission to take you out this afternoon. He has brought me a note from your father, and as today is a half-holiday, I see no reason why I shouldn't give my consent. But you must be back at your house by 6. He understands that."
"Yes, sir."
"You can go now."
I turned my back and began to make for the classroom where I was overdue.
"I meant to go with this gentleman, Baxter 3. What class do you miss?"
"Divers, sir."
"He means divinity," the headmaster told the captain.
He glared at the door across the quad from which wild sounds were emerging, and he swept his black gown back over his shoulder. "From what I can hear, you will miss little by not attending." He began to make great muffled strides towards the door. His boots, he always wore boots, made no more sound than carpet slippers.
"What's going on in there?" the captain asked.
"I think they're slaying the Amalekites," I said.
"Are you an Amalekite?"
"Yes."
"Then we'd better be off."
He was a stranger, but I felt no fear of him at all. Strangers were not dangerous. They had no such power as the headmaster or my fellow pupils. A stranger is not a permanency. One can easily shed a stranger. My mother had died a few years back. I could not even then have said how long before. Time treads at quite a different pace when one is a child. I had seen her on her deathbed, pale and calm, like a figure on a tomb. And when she hadn't responded to my formal kiss on her forehead, I realized with no great shock of grief that she had gone to join the angels. At that time, before I went to school, my only fear was of my father, who, according to what my mother told me, had long since attached himself to the opposing party, up there where she had gone.
"Your father is a devil,"
she was very fond of telling me, and her eyes would lose their habitual boredom and light suddenly up for a moment like a gas cooker. My father, I do remember that, came to the funeral dressed top to toe in black. He had a beard, which went well with the suit, and I looked for the tail under his coat, but I couldn't perceive one. Although this did little to reassure me,
I'd not seen him very often before the day of the funeral, nor after, for he seldom came to my home, if you could call the flat in a semi-detached house named The Laurels near Richmond Park, where I began to live after my mother's death, a home.